It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right, welcome to Money for Lunch. We're off to a great start. I've been talking all week about your goals. They must be clear. Must be clear as to what you want. And I'm talking about vividly clear, okay? It's not good enough to want to lose weight. It's a specific amount of weight that you want to lose. And maybe it's not even weight that you want to lose. Maybe it's a specific look. Maybe you absolutely must have a six-pack. Or maybe you want to be able to squat, you know, X amount of weight, or bench X amount of weight, or run nonstop for a full 10 minutes or something, right? So you have to have a specific goal. Clear, all right? Tom Hopkins, one of our regular contributors, likes to say, if you want to be terrific, you have to be specific. And I like that. It's easy to remember. So if you're being challenged, if you're not being terrific, maybe you're not being specific enough. So you have to be clear. You have to pick a goal that excites you. Now, a lot of people will say, hey, you don't want to pick a goal that's too big because, you know, maybe unrealistic. Well, I say that that's incorrect. Look, unrealistic goals tend to motivate us the most. An example of something that's not very motivating is saying, hey, you know what? I need to make $7,000 a month. Now, $7,000 a month is exactly what you need to pay your bills. So what are you saying? I want to make enough money to pay my bills. Guess what? You're going to come up with that money almost automatically. Some months you might have extra. Some months you might have less than what you need to pay all your bills. But either way, it's not motivating you enough. So if your goal was to make, let's say, $15,000 a month, now that could be motivating. That might not, that's scary. It might excite you. It's challenging. It's got everything of a good goal. It's clear. It's specific. It's measurable. And it's outside of your comfort zone. So anyway, you want to be clear. You want to be specific. You want something out of your comfort zone. And I like to sometimes pick really big, outrageous goals. And I like to look at the leaders of our industry who picked out some big, outrageous goals. Sometimes you hear them as BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals, right? People like Elon Musk, you know. Nobody had done what he'd done. He didn't have a blueprint. And so think about that. Sometimes picking goals that are almost within your grasp may not be as motivating. And then you have to be committed to the process. Sometimes your goals will take time. In fact, most of the time, if they're of any size at all, your goals are going to take time. You're going to have obstacles. You're going to have naysayers. You have to be committed to the process and going through it no matter what. And part of that process is writing down your goals and reviewing them every day. If you're not willing to write them down, then you're not committed. If you're not willing to review them every day, then you're not committed. All right, that's just me. Think about it. If you have questions, hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. All right, let's get this party started with my first guest of the day. Larry Shaliga, one of our regular contributors, is the founder and the CEO of Results Oriented Coaching and Consulting LLC, an organization providing training, coaching, and consulting services dedicated to helping others reach their highest potential. Shaliga has a remarkable 40-year career in a variety of private-owned and publicly traded companies. Most recently, Shaliga helped grow a small privately owned $10 million domestic company into a $150 million worldwide organization. As the co-author of Transform with best-selling author, motivational speaker, and consultant Brian Tracy, Shaliga is sharing his proven strategies, concepts, and techniques. Also joining us is Jackie Bashira. Jackie has helped individuals, teams, and groups transform their thinking and behavior for more than 20 years. Jackie is an evidence-based, results-oriented organization development consultant, an executive coach specializing in transformational learning, mindset recognition, and development and group dynamics. She relies on well-researched, validated theories to develop practical and powerful strategic interventions for her clients. Larry and Jackie, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Hi, Happy New Year, Bert.
Hey, Bert, Happy New Year.
There you are.
It's great to be back.
Good to have you here. Jackie, good to have you here as well. Let's talk about this, because during the last show, we talked about employee engagement. And I want to kind of follow up with that, specifically the magnitude of employee disengagement. Larry, you and I have talked a couple times, I'm blown away by the magnitude of employee disengagement. Why don't you guys talk about that?
Well, I think leading to Bert is that last time we talked, we had mentioned the fact that the Gallup poll indicated that between $450 billion to $550 billion was lost to American businesses because employees disengage. They don't take ownership in the goals, as you were speaking about earlier, the goals of the organization or responsibilities. They're there, they put in their time, and they leave. You know, the old joke, if you don't think the dead can come back to life, stand at the time clock at 5 o'clock. That's what we're talking about.
I like that. Yes, yes. Jackie, your thoughts?
Well, I like to think of it as we had talked before, that nothing happens in a vacuum. And it's my thought that if employees are disengaged, as research is showing, then that's an indication that there's something going on within the whole organization at all levels. And oftentimes we have a tendency to want to isolate, to say, well, it's leadership's fault, or it's employees, you just can't get the right people, or it's this manager or that manager. As opposed to, it is, I look at it as a lighthouse, so to speak, which is letting you know that there is promise here, but we have to figure out what's going on within the system. And so I like to look at it as greater than just one aspect, but it's a symptom that there's something underlying that needs to be addressed within the organization if you're having widespread disengagement, as all the research seems to show.
Right. Well, okay, so let me ask you this.
I agree. And
go ahead.
Yeah, if I can add to that, I have to agree with what Jackie is saying. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, you know, I think I'll do a lousy job today. I think I'll go into work and be frustrated. People want to succeed. All of us want to succeed.
Right.
People, you know, regardless of what level we're at, they are the source of enormous potential. We have to find out how to unlock that potential. And as Jackie said, it's not just one thing. It's a culmination of things. It's the culture. It's the leadership. It's the job. It's the work. Is that where you were going with that, Jackie?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, and it can be. It's a little like a smorgasbord. And it's Bert, before you started our segment, Larry and I were phoned in, and we were listening to you talk about goals, and you know, how do you get to the goals that you want, and. And it really ties in nicely, actually, to what we're talking about, because there's always the push and pull between what the individual wants and what we as the collective want, and what the individual needs and what we as the collective need. And so how do you evaluate those things. And when there is disengagement, it's letting you know that something is amiss. And so in my mind, that actually lets us know there's great promise, but we have to do the work to find out what's actually going on.
Yeah, all right, so let's talk about this, because one of the things that one of the terms that that your research found, and I was very interested by this, is that not only are employees not engaged, but there is a large percentage, 17%, were actively disengaged. What does actively disengaged mean?
So active disengagement is more than just being passive. Those are people who are actually working against the mission and vision and goals of the organization. So you might, some people refer to them as covert actions, or people who are actively engaged in gossip mongering, let's say, or backstabbing. Rather than just being passively not interested, they're actually actively working against what you're trying to accomplish as an organization.
Gotcha. They're also the ones that are actively going to people, other workers, and talking about how frustrated they are, how bad things are, and, you know, quite frankly, that's contagious. So not only are they actively disengaged, they are recruiting others to feel the same way.
Okay, so let's talk about this. How do we correct this? What are the steps to correct this massive disengagement?
Larry, you want to start, and then I'll piggyback off you?
Okay.
Larry, go ahead and start.
I think the first thing, I was waiting for her, but we'll go with that. The first thing that I found, it's, is, you know, number one, like you said earlier, you have to be clear on where you're going. You have to treat the people with respect. If you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinions, their own beliefs, their own values, and too often times we come out and judge those beliefs, those values, it turns people off.
Right.
When you start treating people with respect and listening to their ideas and understanding that they have good ideas too, just because I put damn tie on doesn't mean smarter than the other guy. So we start working together towards a common goal. When we start working together towards a common goal, we start communicating at different levels. I mean, you know, there are multiple levels of communication. The first one is, you know, hey, how are you? You know, I'm really there, but I got to say it.
Right.
You know, that it's a very safe place to be, but we practice that too often. We don't really get to know the other person. We don't know what makes them tick. We don't know what they want. And quite frankly, a lot of times we don't know what we want. We're driven, but that's another whole subject. I think a big part of it is treating people with respect, as I said. I think another part is asking questions out of curiosity rather than trying to trap people or lead people. Find out what's really going on in their mind. Find out what we have to do to make the job better. Listen to their ideas. And I think one of the big things I've found is treat them as if they're adults, because they are adults. We grew up in a world where, you know, we're exposed to parent-child relationships or adult-child relationships. When we're born, as we go through school, we go through the military, we get on the job, it's always adult versus child. And I have found that when I go in and I start talking to my people adult to adult, the response is fantastic. You know, a lot of times some people say, well, okay, the economy is down. Does this mean we're going to, you know, have to lay people off? And the response is always, oh, no, no, we'll find a way around it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, what happens when you say, yeah, the economy is really bad, we're doing everything we can and list the things that we're doing, but you know what? It may come down to that. I've done that, and people come back with, wow, you know, I'm glad you're being honest with me. I know how I have to start budgeting differently with this house. And it's a whole different level of respect. Jackie?
Yeah. Jackie, your thoughts?
Well, I look at it as oftentimes we talk about it in simple terms, in that people are disengaged. How do we get them engaged? We do steps one, two, and three. But I think what we actually have to keep in mind is it's really a very complex situation when you're talking about things that have emerged within an organization. So when I'm, in fact, I'm doing a strategic planning with one of my clients, and I had a session where we had them all in a room and talking about what was their reality. And one of the things that I think is most interesting is it didn't matter at what level the people were at, whether it was someone in senior leadership, whether it was someone in middle management or someone on the front line, it was fascinating to me that they were all talking about the same struggles. They felt unheard. They felt not understood. It reminds me sometimes, Bert, I think about the online dating sites, right? When people say, right, you know, I'm funny, I'm caring, I'm kind, I'm compassionate. If everybody was that, we would have a far different world that we live in. So oftentimes, I think what's happening is that we're all operating out of certain blind spots that we're not aware of. And so I think I'm being open, and I think I'm being transparent, and yet how my behavior is, someone else is reading in a different way. So I think sometimes when there is widespread disengagement, we actually need an outside person to come in that can help sometimes translate between the different levels in an organization or different people. If you think of it, and I love this image of an iceberg, you know, we see behavior, and behavior is the tip of the iceberg. And then we will judge what people's values are, what their beliefs are, what they're thinking. We make assumptions. And all the stuff that we're assessing on is really, you know, the bottom of the iceberg. It's really the crux of things. It takes a long time to really know where people are coming from. And it's interesting when I'm working, whether I'm in a coaching role or a consulting role within an organization, to hear how people will often misunderstand where each other is coming from. So sometimes I think you need someone to come in and help connect some of the dots. And then know that this is not something, oftentimes how culture develops in an organization, it takes a long time. And so putting some of the pieces in place to work more effectively, that takes time too. And so I think the most important thing is that it does take time. And if you have people who are willing to look at themselves as well as looking at the whole of the organization, I think that's what it really takes to begin an effective change process.
Yeah, you know, and I like the tip of the iceberg analogy there, because sometimes the tip of the iceberg will show somebody who's happy, outgoing, and having a great time, but underneath that iceberg, they're having a lot of problems. And you know, we see this all the time where somebody who seems to have a great life will go and commit suicide because we only saw the tip. We didn't, you know, there was no understanding of what was happening with the bigger chunks of their lives. Nobody knew what was happening.
Well, also, if you think about, you're absolutely right. And if you think about, take an organization where, and this is what was happening in one organization I was doing consulting in, where the leadership didn't want to share with the staff some of the financial problems that were happening because they didn't want to scare the staff or to make them full of anxiety or fearful. But what was happening with the staff is the staff was sensing something wasn't right. And they didn't know what was happening. And so then they made the assumption that the people in power and in charge are trying to keep things from us. And really, when you unpack all that, if we look underneath the iceberg, everybody was really trying to do what was in the best interest of the other, but not realizing that without the open communication, and I do think a lot of this begins with an openness in communication, to let each other know where you're coming from. Because certainly leadership can't share all the information all the time, But I think as people, we need to know that we can sense when something is off. And in the absence of information, we start to fill in the blanks ourselves.
Yeah, and we never fill it in with good stuff. It's always bad stuff.
Right, right. Absolutely. And so without the awareness of that, then it's like a virus that inundates an organization. And so I think what's really, Larry and I have talked a lot about this, is how oftentimes people at every level of the organization are actually going through very similar things, parts of where they feel empowered or disempowered, powerful, powerless, and that push-pull is always happening.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. This, I think that disengagement, I think, also happens, and I want to get your opinion on this, guys. It has to do, I think, with ongoing training and interaction, because I think a lot of people, for lack of better terms, they'll get bored, right? They lose the zeal for their position, and so is ongoing training a good way to keep your client, your employees engaged?
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Larry.
Go ahead, Jack.
No,
go ahead.
I think you and I are going to have disagreeing, I think, opinions, which is great. So you start,
okay, good.
And then I'll.
I like it. Yeah, I think training is necessary, but I think we need to identify what training is. My definition of training is getting people together and setting up, providing certain information and then setting it up so that they actually get a chance to experience what it is you're talking about, practice it a little bit, try it out, see what works, what doesn't work, as opposed to somebody standing in front of a room lecturing. So there's a big difference between those two. And I think that depending upon what kind of training you're talking about, does it fit and is it part of a bigger intervention? Building the capacity of our people, I believe, regardless of where we are in the organization, is important. And especially if you start talking about communication skills. Technology today is fantastic. We have things that we didn't have 20 years ago, cell phones, computers, laptops, email, all these good things. Google, you're 20 seconds away from any answer. Just Google it. The downside to that is that people don't talk to each other anymore. So a lot of our interpersonal skills are starting to fade away. I think that training is an excellent way to start bringing some of those interpersonal skills to the surface and giving people a place to practice it where it is safe. So, Jackie, you want to add to or compete with that?
Well, I think it's...
Or conflict with
it? Yes. Well, I think absolutely training is helpful, and I think that it certainly can help develop motivation. But if there is disengagement, then what I would want to know, I would want to know more about what's happening within the organization. Because just adding training could be, it's like someone who has flu or has a sickness and they've got a headache and you're giving them aspirin for the headache, but you're not actually taking care of the underlying sickness. And so, I think training absolutely is beneficial, but if there is distrust in an organization, a lack of authenticity, transparency, people don't feel empowered, people don't feel like they have a purpose, then training is just like aspirin to a headache and not dealing with the underlying issue that's going on. There's a man, he's a career analyst, a lawyer, and
Jackie, we got about less than a minute. Go.
Okay. Well, it's a TED talk by a man named Dan Pink who did a lot of work around motivation, and he said the three things people need to be motivated: they need autonomy, they need a sense of mastery, and they need a sense of purpose. And those three things together help drive motivation.
I love it. Jackie.
I'll just wrap it up with one thing, if I can say it, and we'll sign off, is that I agree with Jackie. Anytime you have prescription without diagnosis, it's malpractice, whether it's in business, consulting, or medicine.
Yep, I think it's a great point, you guys. Larry Shaliga, Jackie Beshear, thank you so much for stopping by, guys. Good stuff there.
Thanks, Bert. Happy New Year.
Bert, talk to you again next time.
Happy New Year, guys. Good stuff there from Larry Shaliga. He is the founder of Results Oriented Coaching and Consulting, and Jackie Beshear, who is a transformational executive coach. Good stuff from there. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
And we're back. My next guest is David Young, a.k.a. Swiss Army Knife, a.k.a. Chief Financial Officer. And David has partnered with industry giant Kodak, and we're going to be talking about what they're doing. David Young, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert. I'm thrilled to be here. It's a beautiful day out in Bellevue, Washington, where I am located. It is probably 20 degrees, clear as a bell. I'm staring at the mountains with Seattle in the forefront. So it's a great day to be on the phone with you and your listeners, and I'm excited to share a little bit about our company, Winning Photos.
Winning Photos. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Winning Photos? What made you want to start Winning Photos, and then catch us up to what you guys are doing with Kodak.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest lures that we saw, and I think this goes to some of the themes of your programming, is that we were just getting back to the power of imagery and how it works to engage users and how those users today are using images. It's a lot different than we used to when I was a child. I'm a Gen Xer. I still remember the days when we drove by a photo mat to perhaps even pick up a yellow envelope with Kodak written on it and get the hard prints of our photos. That's not what we do today. And the amount of photos that are taken and shared on these social media giants like Facebook and Instagram, I mean, those are trillions of photos a year. I think that they're predicting that in 2017 will be the first year where we hit 2 trillion new photos. So our thought was that, gosh, you know, people are taking these photos. What are they doing with them, and how can we be a part of that? How can we facilitate perhaps a little bit better experience for our users? And what we came to were running these global competitions for, I mean, you name the theme and we'll come up with it, where we're trying to get anyone to share cool imagery with our base and perhaps win a prize, get awarded, everyone gets good feedback. And then on top of that, we offer a community for photo enthusiasts to display their work, to perhaps look for mentoring opportunities, to take that next step in their art.
Man, that sounds fantastic. All right, so how does Kodak enter the picture?
Well, when we were looking for a global brand to help us with what we were doing, we started with Kodak and we basically stopped right there. Our research had shown that when people hear Kodak, they think photography, so that was already a huge help for us. The power of the Kodak brand has been something that we're using not only to differentiate our service, but we're looking to really revitalize in the marketplace today. I mentioned earlier that we use photos and images a little bit differently today than we used to. I mean, I think the mass market opportunity obviously is not in developing film. Everything is digital. Everything is shared. And so we are looking to help Kodak and our users together get really into what makes photography unique today. To have those sharing opportunities, to have those wonderful, you know, engaged mentoring opportunities that are out there and available to the audience on a massive scale.
Gotcha. All right. So let's talk about the app a little bit. You guys are demoing it this week at CES, or was this last year?
We will be down at CES this year. We will be in the Kodak booth. We have two demos scheduled each day as part of our participation at that booth, and it's going to be really the prelude to our launch, which will be in mid-January. So we are excited about that. A ton of work has gone into it. Kodak has been a great partner, and we're looking forward to wowing a whole bunch of people down in Vegas this week.
Well, great. So I'm going to stop by your booth.
That would be so great. I would look forward to that, Bert.
So, all right. So tell us a little bit about the app. What can I do with this app? Why should I download this app? Talk about that.
Well, I think when it comes to why, everyone is looking for the quick pitch. And what I've been sharing with people, and you have to stick with me here, is that it's going to make you more attractive to yourself. Now, how do we do that? How can a photo company do that? Or how can an image-based application do that? And I think what we do that no one else is doing is we use imagery as your unique perception on how you see things. We think every person is unique, and we believe that the full manifestation of that comes across in the photos that you share with our audience or the photos that perhaps you would submit to one of our competitions. We want you to feel good about that. We want you to use that for social change. We want you to freely share the images with our audience. And in doing so, if you are so interested and you feel like this is more than just a hobby for you, if this is more than just a small fleeting passion that gets your mind off of your day job, then you can take the next step in our community. So we're going to have these photo competitions. They will run daily, weekly, monthly, I mean, you name it. We'll even be rolling out some event-based competitions that will occur later in Q1. What the cool thing is this is a global competition, Bert. We're doing this on a scale that's never been attempted before, and it's a scale that we believe that we are uniquely suited to manage and to deliver. So we're super excited about it. It'll be available on the App Store and, for Android devices and iPhones and everything in between in mid-January.
And it's called Winning Photos, F-O-T-O-S. And it's interesting that, you talked about Kodak. You talked about the old yellow envelope that we would all go pick up. And then, photos, the way you guys spelt it, is a throwback to the way it was used back in the day when we were picking up those yellow envelopes.
It is. I mean, we want to be very respectful about the heritage and the rich history of Kodak. And we also want to emphasize that we're not just a U.S.-only application. If we run photo contests on, like, show me how you get your water, or what did you do today on your way to work? I think what people are going to find very interesting are the images that are submitted from other countries. And in these countries, some people walk 10 miles to get their water. They don't just open a tap, or they don't just go to a quickie mart and buy something off the shelf. And I think that by making this a global platform and really looking for a global audience, it really emphasizes how every single user or every single participant in our competitions or in our community gets to share a little piece of themselves with the rest of the world. And we hope that that's going to be very rewarding for them. And we are absolutely, totally engaged and looking to build the most, just the best platform for them to share this art with the world and share their unique perspective.
Sure. No, I like that. I think that's very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, you know what? You started off the segment talking about your beautiful day there, looking over, was it Seattle? And
I'm looking right over Lake Washington. I've got Seattle in the foreground and beautiful snow-capped Olympic Mountains in the background. And it's just absolutely, it's freezing outside, I should add, but holy cow, it is a beautiful view.
Yeah, yeah, it's gorgeous because you're inside warm and comfortable.
Yes.
But let's talk about this real quick because, you know, it's interesting that the Pacific Northwest has, you know, either is becoming or has become this hub for startups. I mean, a lot of software, a lot of apps, a lot of startups are coming from that area. What are your thoughts on this? What's the attraction to coming out of starting a company in the Pacific Northwest there?
Well, I think that we have the benefit of having a very broad-based and very successful, I would even call it like a glitterati of brands, not only in technology, but in consumer services and apparel. I mean, we've got Nordstrom and Eddie Bauer, and we have Microsoft and Amazon, and there's so many very large successful companies that have created this environment of entrepreneurialism that surrounds us. We also benefit from the great University of Washington and the great college and university programs that are around the area. We have a lot of young people. We have a lot of millennials, many from Asia and other parts of the world who are all coming here to take advantage of the local talent base and really the freedom of ideas that has become so endemic in this area of the country.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I guess it's a long way, Bert, of saying it's not just the beauty that I'm looking at. There are also some very real human capital, reasons why you would want to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what, David, this has been a fun segment. I cannot wait to – I'm going to be out in CES this weekend, and so we'll connect. I'll stop by the booth, and if you're there, we'll catch up, and I look forward to taking a photo, maybe even a winning photo with you there at CES. And this is I'm excited about you. You're teaming up with Kodak. The app, again, is called Winning Photos, available mid-January on whatever platform you want, either iOS or Android. David Young, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks, Bert. Appreciate it.
Good stuff there from David Young. And the app, again, is called Winning Photos. Can't wait to download it and check it out. And maybe, who knows, maybe you and I could get into a contest and win some stuff. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
And we are back. My next guest, Brian Chivas, built a real estate empire on the principle that anyone with some smarts and a willingness to put boots on the ground can become a successful real estate manager. This updated edition of Buy It, Rent It, Profit is his step-by-step guide for landlords covering topics such as where to buy property and how to pay for it, what to know about tenants and leases, how to keep the business running, and how to grow the business. Additionally, the operations manual section contains virtually every universal form a prospective landlord needs to get started, from leases to property evaluation documents. Chivas also incorporated guidance from building maintenance experts, property attorneys, and tenants' rights organizations throughout the book. Brian Chivas, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. All right, so talk about this. Give me your background story. What were you doing prior to getting into real estate?
Actually, working for about $7 an hour leasing apartments. Back then, we were known as leasing agents. Now I think they're referred to as leasing professionals. Yeah, just leasing apartments, working for, larger developers in the multifamily industry. Then I worked my way up into management. And then from there, I kind of figured I learned enough to be able to try to go out on my own. And, I leveraged the knowledge and the training that I received from the industry and began to create my own company. But it kind of really all started from the educational aspect and then grew from there and built the brand from that point on. The idea was, everything, the brand, everything that I do now was designed and built from me actually literally doing it. And I think that's, what people really buy into and they really resonate and they gravitate towards that it's actually been done. And, I started with $150. And back then the bank was called AmScott or AmSouth. AmSouth. Now I think it was SunTrust, but back then $150 and an idea.
So here you are, you're making $7 an hour as a real estate agent / leasing professional, whatever. And you start thinking, I might be able to do this. And you have a whopping $150 to your name and no prior experience. What was your first transaction? Was it a multi-family apartment type complex?
Correct.
Was it a single home? Okay.
Correct. Yes. Multifamily was all I knew. So that was what I did was I raised money through what I call a private placement. But it started from the educational aspect. That's how I raised my money, putting and performing training seminars. And then, individuals would approach me and I would take a percentage of the deal based on raising money in the beginning. And then once I raised money, I began to kind of master the concept. And from there, I would use the property management arm of my business to participate in much larger deals without having to put my own money into it. So it eventually grew. As I gained more experience in the industry, I began to leverage the knowledge and the experience I had for cash. So in the beginning, I raised money based on my knowledge and my understanding of the industry and managing the properties. And then from there, once I got a track record, there was no longer a need to really raise money or me to come to the table with money when everyone was seeking me out because of my management and my ability to get the project from point A to point B. And I think that's the rubber meets the road. A lot of real estate books teach you about evaluating and analyzing property, but really at the end of the day, people really want to partner with individuals who actually know how to run and operate the property to get it from point A to point B. The easy part to me is buying it. The hard part and the difficult part is actually managing and operating the property to be able to get what you can consider the perceived value out of the asset. We all have an idea or a concept of a rate of return when we buy a property, but, between you and I and tenants, that idea of what you think you're getting on a return can quickly, that can change in a matter of, one tenant or one lease term. So, you definitely have to be able to have someone at a skilled position, the property management position, to be able to navigate the asset from point A to point B from, to exit strategy.
Right. So let me back up, see if I understand this correctly. In the very beginning, were you still working as a leasing agent and then and putting deals together, or did you quit that job and go full force?
Yeah, I never. A bird in the hand's worth more than two in the bush. So I didn't leave one job until I was secure enough to be able to exit. What I did was I started training and speaking at these real estate seminars. And to be honest with you, I would speak anywhere anyone would listen to me. Wherever there was a group of investors who were buying rental property, I would go and speak and teach them how to do it the right way. And then, by meeting these individuals and building a database. Now, everybody has these CRMs and these databases. Back then, it was just an Excel spreadsheet, a piece of paper, and a bunch of business cards. And you would just gather your contacts and build relationships with individuals. And then by the education and training, by me helping other individuals. And to keep the key for me is be of service to others. And because I was of service to others who owned and operated rental property and helped them get from point A to point B, and they quickly realized what I'm telling you now, that buying and owning and operating are totally two different things. So they would appreciate me coming in and helping them to evaluate their current positions, helping them to stabilize their investments. And then there was just natural conversations that took place. Hey, would you mind managing the asset? Then I would manage it, and then take, you know, I would reduce the management fee for a percentage of ownership with some of these properties. Now, you can't do that with single family homes as much because there's not enough meat on the bone. But some of these guys are operating commercial properties and small mid-sized apartment buildings. And so there's enough meat on that bone to be able to negotiate and to be able to leverage. And that's what I did. I mean, it's, you know, it's just an entrepreneurial mindset to me.
Right.
It just so happens that I use real estate, but, you know, like many of your guests that speak, I mean, the one thing we all have in common is the ability to connect dots and have that entrepreneurial mindset and leverage what we have and understand what we don't have.
Sure. And what I like about this, I hope people are picking up on this, is that you're out there, you're speaking about it. So it sets you apart as an expert. It puts you in the spotlight. So investors are thinking, this guy might know something. He's obviously talking about it. He's obviously somebody I need to know. And you know, so whether you're an investor or an owner or a manager, you want to get to know David and Brian, right?
Correct.
Yeah, Brian. And so, and all of a sudden, that makes your work a little bit easier because you have built-in credibility because you just got through, you know, talking about this. And so this all adds up. And then because you had this background as a leasing professional, you know how all that works, which, as you said, is probably one of the hardest parts. You know, it's a completely different animal compared to just buying it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's two totally different levels of operation. When you're talking about investment, you're talking about real estate in general, you have to break it up into five key phases, you know, and those phases are the acquisition phase, the implementation, stabilization, and then what you have is the exit strategy. So those are the five phases that an individual has to be able to navigate. The acquisition phase, there's a ton of people that can tell you how to buy a property, including a ton of books that teach you how to acquire investment property. But then you have, when you buy the property, you have what we call the implementation phase. It's, some people call it the oh shit or the now what, excuse my language phase, where it's like, now what do I do with this property now that I own it? How do I operate it? How do I deal with these tenants? You know, and then, you know, you have to be skilled and have the right kind of skill set to implement the right type of systems. Once you implement the right type of systems, then you go into what we call the stabilization phase. And that is maximizing income and minimizing expenses. And from there, you go to the exit strategy. And that exit strategy is different for each investor depending on their motivation, depending on, you know, what their perceived idea of an exit strategy is. Some people are looking to retire after their portfolio, you know, they obtain a certain amount under their portfolio. The exit strategy is different for everyone.
Right.
But at the end of the day, the idea is getting from point A to point B, from acquisition to exit strategy. There's a lot that happens from the implementation phase, you know, which I see a lot of people make mistakes. They have no clue about what they're doing. They go to a seminar or they buy books, but the books really don't really get into the meats and the nuts and bolts of operating the property day to day. Everybody's so fascinated with evaluation, and there's books on, you know, 100 different ways to evaluate and analyze investment property. I don't need 100 different ways to analyze investment property. I need one or two ways to analyze investment property. What I do need is the ability to operate and stabilize that property. Or you can forget all your fancy formulas on rates of returns because they mean nothing. Because net, you know, most formulas that evaluate value come from net operating income. Well, what makes up 99.9% of net operating income is the rent. So if you don't have a tenant in there paying rent, you don't have net operating income, i.e. you don't have value. So to be honest with you,
i.e. you don't have a business.
It all revolves around the operation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about this since you mentioned you know, the valuation of a property. When it comes to the decision to buy a rental property, where do you start?
When it comes to buying the property, that's a good question, by the way. The process, again, and I'm going to refer to what most people are, what they receive from now social media and various different books. Everyone focuses on an actual building. I don't. That's not what I was taught in the industry, the multifamily industry. What we have is a process. I coined it strategic evaluation of the target area, SEOTA. And what we do is we're evaluating building permit activity, average household size, employment, mortgage interest rates. What else do we income? We're looking at all these various different things, and we're getting an idea of the overall health of a certain economy. And then when we kind of figure out there's an economy or it's conducive to a rental, then what we do is we start looking for investment properties after we've done our initial evaluation. So it's almost military like. There's a whole bunch of various different things we evaluate about an area, because we don't necessarily want to buy a property for what it does today. We necessarily want to buy a property for what we predict it will do in the near future, because when you buy a rental property, it's a long-term strategy. So therefore, you have to be able to forecast 3 to 5 years out. And to do that, you have to have a strong grasp of understanding the demographics and psychographics of certain areas. And demographics tells you who people are and why they do certain things. And so we have to compile all this information. Once we have a demographic profile of a prospect tenant, then what we do is we go find a property that fits that demographic profile. The mistake that most people make, they go find buildings and then try to force feed the building on a demographic profile. So you might buy a building, but the unit mix in that building or the single family home might be a one bedroom, two bedroom. The average household size in that particular area may be 4.7. You just bought a building that doesn't fit the demographic profile. And then you wonder why you're having such a hard problem with filling vacancy rates and why you're probably sitting on Zillow for 30, 40, 60, 90 days. It's because you're doing everything backwards. And, you're putting the buggy before the horse.
Right. Well, and I like what you did there. I like that, you know, you're going in there and you're finding out the demographics of that neighborhood before you step into or you start to evaluate the property itself, because the property, you know, as you suggested, you know, there's all these different evaluations. So the property could be worth millions of dollars, but if you can't rent it out or you can't rent it out at a profit, then it's really not worth anything.
Well, yeah. Again, millions of dollars to whom? The seller?
Right.
So
I have to prove
that it's worth $1 million. The only way I can prove is at the end of the day, when it comes to rental property, buildings don't pay rent. People pay rent. So I evaluate people. I do not necessarily in the beginning evaluate the property. The property comes probably third in the due diligence process. The first thing my job is to do is to identify that prospect tenant and identify what their needs are in advance. It's no different than Walmart or any of these companies that ask you for all this information and give you all these coupons. Because what they're doing is they're really asking this information because they see the items that you buy on the shelves, and they stock the items on the shelves according to the demographic profiles. That's why items on the shelves from one Walmart to the other will change based on the demographic profile from zip code to zip code. So the idea is that we're not building a Walmart and stocking the shelves of what we think people want. We stock the shelves at Walmart with what we know the people want based on their demographic profile, based on what they're buying. That's why they're giving you all these coupons and they're enticing you to give them your information at the register, because they're tracking all this information and there's algorithms to be able to predict what you're going to buy, what to put on sale, how to stock the shelves, so on and so forth. I'm not doing anything different than what big business does. I'm looking at a demographic profile, then I go out and find an investment property that fits that demographic profile, and then I give the prospect tenant what they want.
Yeah, that is so smart, because you're right. That's what business is all about. What is it that your customers want? Give that to them. It doesn't change. And I love this idea that you really need to look at an apartment complex the same way. And if that the demographics of that neighborhood
home.
Or a single family home. If that neighborhood,
let me just throw this, let me throw this in there real quick to your viewers, because most people are going to say, well, he's talking about multifamily. He's not talking about me with my single family. I am talking directly to you with your single family. I'm more so concerned about my single family investors because you only have one source of income coming in. You're at a break-even ratio, which means if I have a duplex or you have a duplex, I have a single family home, I have a vacancy rate, I have a vacant unit, I'm 100% vacant. If you have one vacant unit, you're 50% vacant. You shave 50% off your risk by owning one more unit. But when you have single-family homes, you're operating at a break-even ratio. Therefore, if you have a vacancy and you're sitting on Zillow for 30 to 90 days, you're losing income. And you have to put some of this knowledge that I've just shared to practice even more than the guy who's doing multifamily, because I can hide mistakes in critical mass. It's called scales of economy. If I have a 50-unit
right.
apartment building, I can hide a lot of mistakes in 50 units. I cannot hide
right.
any mistakes in a single-family home. You have to really be on your game. And I just do not see enough educators or books or materials that stress that fact enough. Everybody's always going to talk about getting rich and getting rich, but they don't really understand that there's a lot of risk in that monopoly, five green houses, one red hotel. That's why Monopoly said five green houses, and they didn't say one red hotel and five green houses. They said five green houses and cash that thing in for a red hotel so you can benefit from the economies of scale, because you're really at risk with five green houses more so than the guy with the one red hotel. I don't
yes.
know if that makes any sense.
I love it. No, I think it makes total sense. Absolutely. Yeah, matter of fact, my wife and I used to invest in single-family homes, and it's not a bad way to start, but because of the reasons that you described, we decided to start looking at multifamily dwellings, apartment complexes. I think that's the way to go. It makes more sense. The economics of scale work in your favor. And if there is a little bit more risk, but there's also a lot more reward. I think it's a better way to go.
It is. And the subject of risk, with multifamily, the risk, there's always risk. Anytime you're looking for some of these, anytime you associate a certain cap rate or a certain rate of return and it's typically high, I automatically, anytime you see something that's attractive, and it's a 15, 16, 20% cash-on-cash return or whatever it may be, then automatically that should register to any investor, sophisticated investor, that there's a risk. Anytime you get high cap returns, there's typically means you're going to find undervalued asset. And when there's an undervalued asset, it typically means it's in a troubled area or an area that's undiscovered. No matter what, there's some associated risk involved. And how you have to mitigate those risks is by using the economies of scale. And I'm not saying single-family homes are wrong. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm just simply saying if your approach is to read a real estate investing book and pick up, something off the shelves of Barnes & Nobles or Amazon and just think you're going to, approach, buying real estate investment because you've read a few books, there's a science to this. This is an industry, and you have to really understand the fundamentals of buying rental property, that this is a business, and you are going to become a property manager or, i.e., a landlord. And even if you sub it out, you still better know what your property manager – you need to know as much, if not more, than your property manager so you're able to make sure you're meeting certain milestones and that your properties are being managed and maintained properly. Because if you're going to turn a property over to a property manager and say, hey, look, here's my portfolio, you might as well turn over your iPhone with all your passwords, because at the end of the day, you're putting your whole entire portfolio in the hands of somebody else, and you're basically hoping that they do right by you. You don't need to hope. You need to know that they do right by
yep.
you and make sure that there's checks and balances in place.
Brian, we're out of time. Man, it's been fun to have you on the show. Looking forward to having you back again, talking more about Buy It, Rent It, Profit is the name of the book. Brian Chavis, Chavis, is the best-selling author. You can find his books at Amazon, Simon & Schuster. Brian, like I said, it's been a blast. Looking forward to having you back again.
Absolutely. Find me on Facebook or landlordacademy.com.
Landlordacademy.com on Facebook.
Landlordacademy.com, and I hope to speak to you and see you on our website and chat with you. You can get to
All
me
right.
through live chat.
Excellent. Good stuff there from Brian. I love the fact that he started small over time and developed a portfolio. He didn't just, you know, as he said, one hand in the bush, or was it one in the hand is worth two in the bush, right? Anyway, as always, we're glad to have you guys here. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.